Welcome to the Core Principles Podcast. Thank you for tuning in, and we hope you'll enjoy this lively discussion of relevant topics, which we attempt to examine through the lens of unchanging, objective truth. Here's the host of the Core Principles Podcast, Clay Howerton.
Thank you, Suzanne. Today on Core Principles, I'm honored to welcome Dr. Andrew Bostom. Dr. Bostom is a retired associate professor of medicine at Brown University Medical School. He is an author whose books include The Legacy of Jihad, as well as The Legacy of Islamic Antisemitism. He's also published numerous articles in such publications as The New York Post, The Washington Times, National Review, Front Page Magazine, as well as his own site, andrewbostom.org. Welcome to Core Principles. Dr. Bostom, how are you doing?
Thanks for having me, Clay.
Well, today I do want to talk with you about an article you recently posted on your website, andrewbostom.org. It's called Wilders Islam and the Post-October 7th Liberal Jewish Intelligentsia. But first, I want for our listeners to gain some context and some background. Beyond your work as a medical doctor and as a professor at Brown, what led you to becoming an expert on Islamism and on the pervasive threats to Israel and the Jewish people?
9/11 is really when I began to study as much as I could as a full-time medical academic to study Islam intensely. And my first book was on the jihad. As a matter of fact, I'm just looking now. I invited a great scholar to come to Brown University. I got a small grant to bring her there about a year after 9/11. And I had been reading her work, and she gave this lecture where she described the jurisprudence related to jihad and how the conquered peoples were governed, and I found it so fascinating and she was very encouraging. She actually became a mentor. That I began researching what became the legacy of jihad, largely as a result of that lecture and my earlier interactions with her. I guess what I found most compelling and motivating was that the academic apologetics was already very thick. As a matter of fact, in researching the legacy of jihad, I came across a quote which I found striking, and it was actually published in 1974 by a very good French scholar of Islam, Maxime Rodanson, who had a diverse career, shall I say. He was a full-fledged Marxist. He ultimately rejected Marxism. He was a very anti-Zionist Jew. He never quite shed that. But I thought he was a pretty honest scholar about Islam. He'd actually written a relatively unapologetic biography of Islam's prophet Muhammad. And you could see that he was getting fed up with some of what was going on in the academy, because in 1974, he put it very simply, Clay. He said, "Understanding has given way to apologetics, pure and simple." And so I felt that there was a need for more honest discussion that jihad wasn't, for example, an interspiritual struggle. I mean, it was conquest, and it had rules that were very carefully articulated, and it had obviously had consequences like any other form of conquest for the conquered peoples. I also rediscovered many scholars in the period sort of before Rodanson described who were completely unapologetic. And it was a large project, because a lot of the work, some of the work was in English, but a lot of the work was in European languages. And then, of course, the primary sources were in Arabic, some were in Farsi. So I had to get translators. I'm not fluent in any of those languages. But it was both fascinating and depressing at the same time. And I guess what I came away with was that these institutions, the jihad, the system of governance, the Sharia, the imposition of Islamic law on non-Muslims, these are very much living institutions. They may not be as fully followed as they were 1,000 years ago or 500 years ago. But boy, they're still quite vibrant, surprisingly vibrant. And then when it came to anti-Semitism, in a certain way, that was almost more shocking, because the apologetic literature of the last 50 years basically denied the fact that there was any theological anti-Semitism in Islam, which I just found shocking, just from my initial reading of the texts themselves, the Quran, the traditions of Muhammad, the sacred Muslim biographies of Muhammad. They had very in-your-face anti-Semitic themes, and yet these had been sort of hand-waved away, and that didn't make much sense to me. But once again, I discovered some scholars, both Jewish scholars and non-Jewish scholars, that had treated this material very matter-of-factly, although in this case, you had to go back to the late 1930s, 1940 or so, to see very straightforward treatments of the anti-Semitic themes in the Quran, the anti-Semitic themes in the traditions. But there they were, and I actually had the privilege of translating, or having translated, a 70-page essay by a Hungarian rabbi who did most of his scholarship in France, Georges Vajda. This magnificent 70-page essay with over 200 references on the anti-Semitic traditions in the Hadith. And I felt very privileged to be able to put that out, you know, for the first time in full with all the annotation in English, and was frankly rather surprised and disappointed that it hadn't been done by people who had spent their careers in Middle East studies, you know. It was a journey of discovery. It's not pleasant material, Clay, but I think it's important to put out there in an unapologetic way.
Oh, we see its importance in current events. Now, the mentor that you mentioned early on there, was that Bat Yair?
Yes. Her name is Giselle Littman. She wrote for a while under a pseudonym, which means daughter of the Nile. She was an Egyptian Jew. Her family was forced, you know, like the conditions were after the 1948 war, and for the next 20 years or so, you know, basically the choice was a suitcase or a coffin, as they put it. And you know, they about 900,000 Jews were forced out of the Middle East. About 2/3 of them settled in Israel, and about 300,000 maybe settled in Europe and in the Americas.
Well, God bless her for good works and for inspiring you. Now, you mentioned anti-Zionist Jews, and I've always been confused that a lot of Jewish people do not seem to be pro-Israel. Can you help me understand that?
It's difficult for me to understand too, in many respects. But I mean, if you take it at face value, there are just Jews who, I guess, were happier with the condition of the Jews or in the diaspora. That some for supposed religious reasons, others for secular ideological reasons, very hard left Jews often.
I was going to ask about that.
I mentioned Rodin San. I think he mellowed a little bit because he became anti-communist. But I could certainly understand why he would be anti-Zionist when he was a full-throated Marxist. That was just the nature of Marxism. Although, you know, Marxism being will glom onto anything that to its advantage. So there may have been brief periods where there was more sympathy towards the Zionist movement, but over the course of time, I would say, you know, for since the Russian Revolution, predominantly it's been an anti-Zionist ideology, Marxism.
I have a thought about that. You can help me understand whether I'm on the right track or maybe off, but it seems to me that leftists, whatever else they may be, are leftists first. And another example would be feminist leftists. They will now go along with the utter cancellation of women in athletics just because their leftism says we're supposed to be for the underdog, which now is the LGBTQIA plus whatever.
Right.
And so women get out of this people's way if they want to pretend to be women and dominate your sport.
Right.
Leftists are leftists first.
Exactly. And I think that that very much characterizes the anti-Zionist left. But there is a cadre of people who come at their alleged, you know, that's what they claim. They come to their anti-Zionism through their reading of scripture. You know, I don't think they're not really the significant anti-Zionists at this point. I think the significant anti-Zionists, in addition to, you know, of course, the Muslim world, is the left.
Well, now, getting to your article and current events and how these things tie, on Wednesday, the 22nd of October, Hert Wilders, and I don't speak Dutch, so I may have butchered his name, Hert Wilders and his Party for Freedom won an electoral victory in the Netherlands. And I wanted to ask you why that is significant in relation to the topic of defending against anti-Semitism and against the attacks on Israel and Jews.
Yeah, it was more recent. It was just this November.
I'm sorry, 22nd November.
Yeah, 22nd November. Hirt has been, first of all, he's traveled throughout the Middle East, and he's always had, before he was a politician, because I've actually gotten to know him, he just had a fondness for Israel. He appreciated the freedom in Israel. He's kind of a libertarian. I mean, you know, they attach all these ridiculous labels in Europe. He would just be a libertarian centrist slash maybe conservative in the United States on so many issues. But he appreciated the industriousness of the Israeli population, and he was also he also contrasted it with the Muslim societies that he was exposed to in the Middle East, where he certainly didn't see any of the freedom, and he was concerned that the populations were I don't think he came to this until later. I think he ultimately realized that a lot of what was holding them back was sort of this, you know, Sharia compliant Islam, and he certainly believes that now. As a politician, he's been very concerned about not so much immigration of Muslims per se, if they weren't attempting to impose the Sharia on Dutch society. He doesn't have a problem with secular Muslims. He doesn't have a problem with Muslims that will simply integrate into Dutch society, which is another misconception about him. He's very concerned, though, about mass migration of Muslims that see the Netherlands as a place to plant their flag and establish at least initially a parallel society and then ultimately Islamize the entire society. He's openly and forcefully opposed to that. And he also is very forthright about how the migration into the Netherlands and other parts of Europe has fomented anti-Semitism, because he, in his own study of Islam, you know, obviously he hasn't had the time to study it the way I have, but he feels that he believes that there is intrinsic anti-Semitism in the doctrine and that he sees it play out in Dutch society. He's very much concerned about that. One of the things that's interesting is to see how strong his policy positions are for Israel, which is you know, despite the tarring of him as a you know, you'll see far right, you know, Geert Wilders, people have, certainly Jews in Europe are finally beginning to realize just how serious and committed he is to Israel, because now he has a 20-year career. But his positions were laid out like this in the run up to the last election, that he wanted the Dutch embassy in Israel to move to Jerusalem. That he believes that Jordan is the only true Palestinian state. And you have to realize, Clay, that Jordan is actually 78% of the original mandate for Palestine. Where and the mandate just said that Jews would be able to settle in these areas. It didn't claim the land for them. This was the League of Nations mandate. And to this day, you know, with the you know, Britain lopped off that portion and gave it to the Hashemites. Again, 78% of the original mandate, and it was established that by law, in fact, certainly with full control by the Hashemites, that it's what you call in German Judenrein. It's a Jew-free territory, and those laws are still in place that no Jew is allowed to settle in what was originally 78% of the mandate, which was the whole purpose was to allow Jews, you know, to settle in this region. So Wilders argues that it's the only true Palestinian state because it's majority Palestinian now, and his party doesn't favor the creation of another state. He also supports the right for Israelis to settle in Judea and Samaria, the West Bank. He also opposes the Cairo Declaration, which is a Muslim version of the UN Human Rights Declaration called the Human Rights Declaration in Islam. And he opposes it because it's subordinated to Islamic law, to the Sharia. And then his last position was that he was committed to, in the Netherlands, he was committed to fighting anti-Semitism as defined through the Holocaust Agency. And he added this, as promulgated, particularly, quote, from an Islamic viewpoint, because, again, he was very concerned about the anti-Semitism that he was seeing, not just in the Muslim world, but in the Muslim diaspora population in Europe, including in his own country. So, I mean, you know, it's a very straightforward platform. And I think, you know, it maybe and that was the point of my essay, Clay, was that I'm hoping that, you know, there's supposedly been this epiphany that Jews, and not just, you know, I mean, you're probably never going to get through to Jews that are basically more, you know, hard left slash communist than they are Jews, but to liberal Jews that are not progressive Jews or that have moved away from progressivism, if they've really had this epiphany after the horrors, after the butchery, which we're still learning about, on October 7th, and they grudgingly now admit that, gee, maybe Trump's policies were preferable to what the Democrats have been engaged in all these years. Then I just put it out as a challenge to them, Clay, that they should support Geert Wilders.
Yes, and he sounds.
But I'm not holding my breath.
I understand. He sounds very much like a Netherlands First candidate, and like a pro-Israel, and he sounds very much then like Donald Trump, who was, you know, our own country first, and Israel is a great ally, and we're going to be, I think Donald Trump was the most pro-Israel president we've had in my lifetime. Well,
I agree with you, Clay. He was.
By action, if nothing else. So the liberal Jewish intelligentsia then that you referred to are these folks that you're talking about that are not hardcore left, progressive, whatever they call themselves, but are the thinkers, and you're saying you're hopeful that some of them may wake up and say, you know what, these folks have been pushed off as far right are actually just pro-Israel, and maybe that's pretty cool. Do you, you mentioned Barry Weiss. Do you have any other examples? And
I thought she was an important example because she gave a very, very much ballyhooed speech at the Federalist Society. And it was actually the Barbara Olson Memorial Lecture. And she, you know, to a certain extent went through certain, I guess you would call it mea culpa process. There are other journals, you know, you could look at like Tablet Magazine, perhaps, I would say Jews that are Democrats but not progressives, those sort of Jews, or Jews that were, you know, never Trumpers but were not, maybe even Republicans. who now would reconsider in the wake of the horrors of what took place on October 7th. But she sort of crystallized a lot of things for me, because she was very, she actually moved from the Wall Street Journal, where she'd been a reporter, to the New York Times, because she felt the Wall Street Journal editorial board wasn't critical enough of Trump. Then she went to the New York Times, and they were way too left for her. They were progressives. They were neo-Marxists. They were real totalitarians. And so she created the Free Press. And, you know, the Free Press was supposed to be something, I guess, for centrists, maybe center left. And we'll see, you know, I mean, it's done some better, certainly. And it's gotten, the Wall Street Journal reported, Clay, that a lot of Jews that were, again, liberal, non-progressive Jews were switching from the New York Times to the Free Press, at least in terms of the coverage of what's happened since October 7th.
Very
so
good.
But the proof will be in the pudding. You know, I'm not really that optimistic. I think, you know, Wilders needs to form a government. And you would think that now would be the time for some of these voices to say, you know, first of all, he deserves it. I mean, there's so many parties, but he got 35, 36 seats. I forget what the final tally was. I mean, that's a huge chunk of their parliament for any one candidate to get. And he's got to cobble together a coalition, though, so he can govern.
Well, we definitely need to talk about immediately current events. So this week, presidents of some leftist universities like Harvard and Penn spoke at congressional hearing regarding the demonstrations on their campuses in which students were chanting slogans that indicated support for genocide against the Jews. And the university presidents could not bring themselves to condemn that evil. Penn president Liz McGill said such words aren't really harassment, but if they became actions, then they might rise to the level of harassment. Now, Dr. Andrew Bostom, how have university students become so corrupted in their minds as to cheer for terrorists and to hate Jews?
Well, first of all, I want to give Representative Stefanik great credit, and also Representative Kiley for grilling these university presidents and pointing out their hypocrisy in such a simple and striking way, where they could not simply state that these calls for genocide were against the policies of harassment. I mean, they had to contextualize it. You know, I mean, it's just, and at one point, Stefanik said, well, what do you mean? They actually have to start committing genocide before it's contextualized enough for you? I mean, it was stunning testimony. I see some large donors like Mr. Ackman came out with statements and said, all three of these people need to be fired. You know, and he has a lot of weight because he's a billionaire and he's donated over the years. Look, you know, these donors, these are very prestigious institutions. It's not really a political thing for some of these donors. They feel like they're contributing to institutions that are going to train the next generations of doctors and scientists and engineers, you know, and supposedly great thinkers, you know, in the humanities. And so, you know, it's their fault in the end, but they may not have been paying attention to this ideological shift that's taken place. But some of them are seeing it now. I think what's happened is it's a combination of things on these campuses. The drift to the hard left, I mean, we're talking about, you know, neo-Marxist ideologies, with the post-colonial theory and the DEI. These are Marxist ideologies, basically. But also, I think there's been a tremendous influx into an expansion of the Islamic studies departments which bring their own baggage with them in terms of anti-Semitism. And unfortunately, Clay, the Muslim students, you know, look, I usually preface what I say with this, but we have hard metrics. My training was in epidemiology, so I'm very used to looking at survey methods and data analyses, and this is these are simple data. The ADL developed an instrument about 20 years ago that was based on, it was elegant and simple. They went through two iterations, but basically they're the same. They take they confront the respondent with 11 anti-Semitic stereotypes that anyone in their right mind, I think, would agree are anti-Semitic statements. And they see how many the individual agrees with. And if they agree with more than half of them, so if they agree with at least six out of the 11, they become an index case of extreme anti-Semitism. Then they measure the prevalence of the commonality of how much of each population that they're studying, whether it's regions or individual countries or subpopulations within countries. How common is agreeing with at least six out of 11 of these anti-Semitic stereotypes? And the 16 most anti-Semitic countries in the world are all in the Middle East and North Africa. And the prevalence of this degree of anti-Semitism is anywhere from 74 to 93%. With the highest prevalence, unsurprisingly, being in Gaza and the Muslims of Gaza and the Muslims of Judea, Samaria, West Bank. It's unfortunately this is now traveling outside the Middle East. So, for example, in the latest surveys, they took a hiatus. They started up again after COVID. So the end of the year of 2022, they published in May, they at least had two European countries with sizable Muslim populations, Belgium and France. There was 62% of this degree of anti-Semitism amongst the Muslims of France, and in the low to mid 50s, if I recall, in Belgium. And that's against background rates of maybe 15 to 20% in the Christian populations. And of course, you know, Western Europe has its own history of anti-Semitism, but you can see how much more common it is amongst the Muslim populations. And that mirrors what ADL has found for 20 years now, which is if you just look globally across the world, that the anti-Semitism in Muslims as a religious group compared to Christians, the Buddhists, Hindus, those who profess no faith, is anywhere from 2 to 4-fold higher. That's across the world.
Then, of course, that doesn't even approach the organizations like Hamas, whose stated purpose is every Jew must die.
Yeah, that's annihilationist. Although I will say in Palestinian society, there's at least some older data on that. Stanley Greenberg was a longstanding Democratic pollster, particularly did a lot of polls for the Clintons when, you know, they were a political force. He's always been a very good pollster. He went to Israel and to the territories, to Gaza and the West Bank. And he polled a little over 1,000 Palestinians in Arabic with his team. And they took two articles out of the Hamas covenant. There's an article 7, which reproduces a tradition from Muhammad, which basically says that Jews have to be massacred to usher in the Messianic age. It's what's called a canonical hadith. And then there's another article, 15, I believe, which is a long article about the need to wage a global jihad against Israel, not necessarily to slaughter all the Jews, but to crush the state and remove it as a political entity. And so for the first article, which was just basically Jew annihilationist, there was 73% support. And for the second article, which was to destroy Israel as a political entity, it was 80% report. And I don't think that the situation has improved since 2011 when those survey data were collected and reported. The sentiments are very, very strong. You see it, and you know, it's not difficult to discern.
Well, as we wrap up, I really do appreciate your fact-based approach. I know that you're a medical scientist and that you deal in the real world, although not all medical scientists do these days, but I want to conclude.
COVID should have taught us that.
Yes, sir. I want to conclude by asking you more of an opinion-based thing, but now our listeners know for certain this is going to be an expert opinion that you give based on your background and your studies. At these leftist-run schools like Harvard and Penn that we've talked about, it's unacceptable now to call a person with Y chromosomes in every cell of his body a man, but it is acceptable to chant slogans expressing a desire to murder Jews. Can we repair these outrageously broken universities?
It's going to take a long, it took a long time to get here, Clay. It's going to take a long time. You know, I was shocked at some of the ideologies I saw. I mean, I was kind of protected from it, I guess, because being most, you know, at the medical school. But I went on to the undergraduate campus either to do research or, you know, occasionally to go to a seminar or something like that. And it's been a long standing problem. It's going to take a long time to change. And I hope the hearings that you mentioned with the presidents from MIT and Harvard and Penn were so shocking to people and particularly to donors, because donors can change things much more quickly than the ordinary person. I hope that resonates. And I just wanted to point out I had seen, you know, Middle East Media Research Institute does a lot of, just reporting, and then translating into English, mosque sermons, political statements throughout the Middle East. And now in the diaspora populations, in Muslim diaspora populations. And there, a couple of weeks ago, they published a sermon from an imam in California, where he was calling for mass killing of the Jews, basically, and it turned out it's been a little while, but one of his earlier jobs was as the Muslim chaplain at the University of Pennsylvania. So it's like, oh well, you know, it kind of, I mean, now I doubt he was so indiscreet when he was the Muslim chaplain, but God knows what he said when he met privately with the students there. If this can be now that he's got his own gig as an imam, he's happy to say this publicly now. And then also there was a Jerusalem Post story in 2006 where the president of the University of Pennsylvania at the time, I thought it was a Photoshop. I found the original story. She's at a Halloween costume party and she's, I don't know what she's dressed up as. She looks like a princess or something, you know, very anti-feminist kind of look, but she's next to a Syrian engineering student who looks the part, but who's got a fake Kalashnikov and a suicide bomb vest on. I mean, what is the thought process that it's not the least bit funny? I mean, this is the mentality, you know. I thought it was a Photoshop. I said, come on, you know. And I found out there was a Jerusalem Post story in 2006 about how inappropriate this was. And that was the former president of the University of Pennsylvania.
Well, hopefully donors of these big schools, please express that this has got to change. It's not acceptable to indoctrinate students into this kind of hate mongering. That should be obvious. Anyway, the moral vacuum in Liz McGuire, I'm sorry, or McGill, UPenn president.
Yeah,
she came out today and said, well, I got to contextualize this. I got to explain that obviously genocide is bad, but there's no reason for her hesitance at that congressional hearing. Like, I'm not really sure.
That hearing said it all. all three of them. As a matter of fact, I thought Kevin Kiley, if you know him, the congressman from California, who's a conservative congressman, he was so upset with the Harvard president. I wrote it down. After he was done questioning her and she gave the same sort of answers that you saw in the exchange with Representative Stefanik, he says, you clearly seem to believe that the forces of anti-Semitism are a constituency that needs to be catered to. I said, that sums it up absolutely beautifully. And he says, I think that's clear from your silence, from the carefully parsed statements and the Orwellian passive voice. And unfortunately, that message was heard loud and clear by forces of anti-Semitism on your campus and has reverberated across American higher education. It was such a beautiful way to summarize what was going on.
Constituencies, that's part. Jesse Waters pointed out that some of those constituencies may be foreign governments who funnel cash into
Qatar in particular.
Yeah. So we don't have time to delve into that side topic, but it is interesting and sort of terrifying because these are training up our youth and, you know, these are prestigious organizations. People spend lots and lots of money to send their children there.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you for being my guest on Core Principles, Dr. Andrew Bostom. God bless you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Core Principles podcast is produced in Paducah, Kentucky by Real Productions. Music is by Late July, L-E-I-G-H-T July. You can find her music on all streaming services or at latejuly.com. Thank you for joining us today for this episode of the Core Principles podcast. Please visit core.buzzsprout.com for more information. And please share with your friends. We look forward to visiting with you again on our next episode.